Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today. And I want to go straight away to Dr. Austin O'Carroll. Austin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Yeah,
thank you for having me on.
Thank you. You got in touch with us, Austin, and I just want to stress, because I know you want to be clear about this, that you are going to be speaking in a personal capacity. But it's in relation to this apology that we were reading about. It emerged yesterday evening that the government, I'm just reading the Irish Times headline here, government apologises for hardships suffered by thalidomide survivors. The RTE headline, government apologises to thalidomide survivors. You have an issue with that apology, Austin.
Yes. Okay. And as I said, I'm not speaking on behalf of the IGA. It's personal. First of all, I am very glad that the three leaders of the parties took this issue on and are finally taking political responsibility to try and start a process. However, they issued a statement which looks like an apology, sounds like an apology, but absolutely is not an apology. And whether inadvertently or not, they've caused huge hurt and upset to people. Because a key demand for people with thalidomide is that we get a fulsome apology for the wrongs that were done by the state.
Let me just stop you there 1 second. And just in case there is anybody who's been living under a rock for the last 60 years and is not familiar with the detail of this, this all goes back to the early 60s when mothers who were suffering from morning sickness were prescribed this wonder drug, this drug that was going to help them, thalidomide under various brand names. And it was fairly quickly linked to deformities, defects in fetal defects that were to cause lifelong disabilities, and in most cases, and this is in your own case, shortening of limbs was a huge issue for the babies born in these cases. So you have been campaigning for all your life, like you, I mean, you're an incredible man, Austin. I mean, indeed you are. You overcame your disabilities, and a very significant disabilities, and you're of course a GP now, and you're working with a lot of marginalised communities. But this campaign, which has been ongoing for decades and decades, and one of the key demands has been for all those years, for the state to take responsibility and apologise for what was done. And what wasn't done, actually, is the case, isn't it?
Exactly. And because if we go back to the statements, they mentioned the word sorry, they mentioned the word regret. But like, I can say, I'm sorry that it's raining outside, I regret it's raining, but I'm not apologising because I didn't cause the rain. So a fulsome apology is where you recognise what you did wrong. And there are four significant things we think the state did wrong. If I can detail those.
Please do, yeah. And you know what? Let me just, because so people will know what we're talking about, I'll just read the few lines that refer to the apology in the statement that the coalition leaders put out last night. They say, "We want to take this opportunity to express our sympathy to survivors and their families. We are sorry for all they have endured, for the hardships they have suffered and for the impact thalidomide has had on their lives. We want to strongly reiterate once again, their mothers did nothing wrong and we have never thought otherwise. It is regretful that the regulatory standards we have today were not the norm here or internationally when thalidomide was first brought to the market." Now, that's the one that really is an issue.
Well, it's a big issue. Well, there are several issues. The first issue is that's actually false. The US had regulator standards and they actually stopped the input of thalidomide because they had significant concerns about it. And as a result, a few people got thalidomide in the States because thalidomide was posted over to them, but no one got thalidomide through the shops or the regulation or through doctors' prescriptions because they had stopped it at source. So there was a regulator authority that stopped the introduction of thalidomide.
Yeah, so the regulatory standards of that time were enough to save the American mothers and babies from this drug. But
Yeah.
Okay, that's the first point. Go on.
Yeah, and the second point is that the it's well known that the Irish state at the time, the drug was withdrawn in November 1961. There was an international withdrawal of the drug. And in every other state, they sent out withdrawal notices and they announced it publicly, told people not to take it, told doctors not to prescribe it, told pharmacists to take it off the shelves. They did not do this in Ireland. They tried to silently take it secretly, but made no public announcement. As a result, many pharmacists didn't hear about this and had the medication. Many doctors had free samples in their surgeries, and people were given thalidomide after the withdrawal date. If the government had announced it publicly, that wouldn't have happened. And there are several people who have that's been affected by, some of them acknowledged and some of them unacknowledged. And that is something the state needs to apologise about, because we've suffered as a result of that. I was born in May 1962, not long from November. I may be one of those children. I don't know.
And the other issue there, of course, was that mothers who might have been prescribed it for a previous pregnancy might have had it in their medicine cabinet and, absolutely, again, could not have known that there was any issue with it.
Absolutely. And the really powerful thing about this is you only need to take one tablet to cause huge disability. So, for example, I have one friend who has literally only small stubs for all four limbs, and that was because their mother took one tablet. So it wasn't that you had to have a store, all you had to have to do is one tablet. A public announcement would have prevented so much harm and destruction to people's lives.
There's another issue, Austin, though, isn't there, in regards to what was promised at the time to survivors?
Yeah, there's two more issues. The first issue, in 1970s, the government and Grünenthal, the organisation who developed it, did come up with, wasn't a compensation package, but was an agreement to pay monies towards survivors. And this was a small lump sum and then a monthly amount. It was not the same as getting proper compensation. For example, other countries would have done better than us. There's two things about this. As part of that deal, they agreed that they would have a fulsome medical package to take care of the health of people with thalidomide. Now, we're delighted to see that this health package is coming in now. We're delighted we were somehow involved. We still have some things we'd like to be adjusted. However, this was supposed to have been in place back in the 1970s. And as the result of the fact that it hasn't been in place, many people with thalidomide have suffered, including myself, that would have not suffered if they had the package in place. So while it's very welcome, it's 40 years, over almost 50 years late, they need to apologise about that. If I can give you my own story, Katie, I had a problem with a nerve in my wrist called carpal tunnel syndrome, mm-hmm. and I went to a really good surgeon to get it fixed, and I was done under local anaesthetic, so I was awake. Now, I remember him opening up my wrist, and as he looked up, he said, oh, the anatomy is all different, and he couldn't find the nerve for a long time. Eventually, he found the nerve. Not long after that surgery, I lost the extension of my hand, and I now have a significant deformity of my hand. I don't think that surgeon. He was an excellent surgeon. However, if this package had been in place back then, I would have access to go to Germany, where there are specialist people who deal with thalidomide that would have known the anatomy of thalidomide, and I would probably not have been left with a disability. There were other people who were in my similar situation. So while it's very welcome, we need an apology that it wasn't put in place when it was agreed to put in place back in the 70s.
Absolutely. And just say, because, of course, there was, I think, something like 5,000 thalidomide victims in Germany, because that was the company that developed it was actually a German pharma company. So they would have had the expertise there. They would have known what the inside of your wrist would have looked like before
exactly,
that surgery.
The key determinant of how good a surgeon is how many times they've done a similar operation. And over in Germany, there's 5,000 people. They've done a lot of operations. In Ireland, there's so few of us. The surgeons don't have the expertise. So we lost out by going through surgeons who are really good surgeons, but just wouldn't have the knowledge or expertise.
And the fourth one, Austin.
And the fourth one is it was to do with the agreement in the 1970s. Oh, yes. All agreements where children are involved, legal agreements, go in front of the High Court. When they go in front of the High Court, the reason is that we want to be certain that a legal agreement has been fair to children, because children are vulnerable and that the agreement hasn't exploited this vulnerability. This happens to every case involving children. The only case we know of that this wasn't involved in was the case of people with thalidomide. Our legal agreement was not put front to the High Court. And there are only two reasons, like, this should have happened. There's only two reasons this couldn't have happened. One is they knew it wasn't a proper agreement and they didn't want that to be notified by the High Court. Or secondly, they felt they had done wrong in not taking it off the shelves and they wanted to hide that. Now, the consequences of that are we could have ended up having a better agreement if the High Court had said it. But secondly, the High Court could have put in protection. I was very lucky. My parents were given a small lump sum at the start, and they got this monthly sum, and they saved it and invested it wisely, and I actually did quite well. Mm-hmm. But people with being thalidomide, some parents didn't know what to do with it, left it, and it lost value. Other parents used it for their own purposes, not for the children at all, and those children lost everything and did very poorly. If it had gone front to the High Court, those protections would have been put in place that wouldn't have happened. The state needs to apologise about that as well.
Austin, and even the way this came out, because I mean, I was looking back at the other state apologies we have had over the last 10 years or so, going back to the February 2013, that was the Magdalene, the apology from Enda Kenny to the residents in the Magdalene Mauderies on behalf of the state. There was 2019, there was the apology for it by those affected by the failings in the cervical check screening programme. 2018, there was an apology as part of a motion in the Dáil to those who were affected by the criminalisation of homosexuality. And in 2022, there was a state apology to the mother and baby institutions, to those residents of mother and baby homes. And of course, we had very recently the apology to the victims of the Stardust. All of those were big deals, as in there was a big moment in the Dáil. There was, you know, statements, there was press conferences. This apology was like slipped out yesterday evening with no bells and whistles.
This apology, first of all apologies you said are right in front of the Dáil, this wasn't.
Yeah.
And secondly, is they're always done in conjunction. If they had come to us and talked to anyone with thalidomide, we would have been able to tell them. Giving a seeming apology or an impression that there's an apology will cause great offence. I mean, the whole idea of us coming to a negotiation, a mediation, is that the apology needs to be agreed between the two of us and not a half-hearted impression of one being given. I had so many people ringing me up saying, you got the apology, and I had to say, we didn't. They didn't. Apology means accepting responsibility.
I have to say, when I read this last night, that was my very first thought, was that I was looking for the place in the apology where responsibility was being taken on behalf of the state, and I couldn't find it. Do you know what's useful? Because there was a state apology given to thalidomide victims in Australia last year, and the Prime Minister gave that apology in the Parliament. And I have just a clip of how that apology was made and the stark difference to what we're talking about here today.
But without question, the heroes of those proceedings are the survivors and their families who shared their stories with such searing honesty. The people who put on the parliamentary record a hard truth too long denied. Their courage demands that at the heart of this national apology must be an acceptance of Australia's moral responsibility. So today, as we express our sorrow and regret, we also acknowledge the inescapable historical facts. The fact that even after the grave dangers of this drug were known, importing thalidomide was not prohibited. Selling it was not banned. Products and samples in surgeries and shops were not comprehensively recalled or entirely destroyed. Saying sorry does not excuse this or erase it. There are no words that can undo what has been suffered. There is no sum of money that can square the ledger.
Yeah, Austin, that sounds more like what... Yeah, the moral responsibility is acknowledged there.
I mean, he says it doesn't make a difference, but actually it does. The fact, the recognition that this shouldn't have happened, And even in the statements, they said they noted that, you know, regulation of drugs in pregnancy didn't occur before thalidomide. We actually were the first group, and because of us, everyone else in society has benefited, because everyone else, drugs were much more carefully used in pregnancy. So
this is the kind of the canary in the mine case, really, which saved so many other people from this scenario.
And just we're saying we regret, you know, we recognise this, regret, but don't recognise that actually they also contributed to what happens.
Can I ask you, because you're talking, Austin, about all those calls you've had from other people and you know, people, just you personally, because you've been banging this drum for all your life, basically. How do you feel personally, or how did you feel personally when you saw that? All the people who are acknowledged thalidomide survivors got letters to this effect last night. Is that right?
They did. And my initial reaction was very angry because of the seeming apology. In the letter, they didn't indicate, they just indicated they were going to do a health package without addressing our other demands, which was an apology and appropriate compensation and to make the health package to be absolutely secure. But anyway, in their press statement, it seems to me that there are other possibilities. So we welcome that there may be processes going forward, but I know I can't speak on behalf of the organisation, we're going to be meeting ourselves. But I was really angry that this wasn't a seeming apology, particularly when people started ringing me. Because, you know, initially you wonder, oh, is it just me seeing this, mistaking this as a seeming apology? But everyone got this impression, and it was wrong. And it's caused hurt and upset, because an apology is, people often think it's just an extra. It's a really key part of this process.
Well, I was just looking at something Leo Varadkar said. There was a Dáil discussion around state apologies last year, and Leo Varadkar actually said, when it comes to an apology, I have made apologies in this house as Taoiseach. I have no difficulty in making them, but I do know something about making an apology in this house. First, it has to be adequate. The people who receive the apology have to believe that it is adequate and sufficient, and it has to be sincere. I mean, so is there a cynicism behind this? Putting this out, having the headline saying, oh, finally the thalidomide survivors have got their apology. What do you think, Austin?
First of all, I too know about making apologies, because as a doctor, I have to apologise every now and then to patients who things have gone wrong for. And if you're going to give an apology, you have to go and be fully in there and accept the responsibility. I think whether this is inadvertent or whether they wanted to create an impression that it was an apology, I don't know. But what they, even if it was inadvertent, they could have totally avoided that by consulting with us before they issued the statement. And that's what they always, when they issue anything that sounds like an apology, in any other case I know of, they have consulted with the organisation. And that's the indefensible part. They should have consulted with us, because we would have been able to tell them this was going to cause hurt and upset.
Yeah, and the last thing you want at this stage of the, oh my God. And it is the most bad, because I have been covering this story I've only been covering it for, 10 or 12 years. Others have gone back much further. And I'm going to bring in Olivia Leary now in one moment, because she goes back right to the early 70s, the earliest uncovering of the scandal of this. But it's baffling to me. There's just 40 acknowledged survivors left. We know there's another maybe 10 people that you're fighting to get their cases acknowledged. But it's a tiny cohort of people. The amount of money involved in this is tiny in comparison to an €8.5 billion budget that we had yesterday. What is your take on why it is so hard to sort out?
The only way I can is they somehow think they're not responsible or weren't involved, which I cannot understand. I don't know if it's their lawyers aren't advising them of exactly where the mistakes were made or what, but I just somehow think that when they hear the story, they don't really get the detail that the state was involved in this and caused this. And that's what, I mean, basically people don't take on a case. We've been since 2005, 20 years. People don't, when I hear people take on the case, some people can get cynical. People don't take on a case, hang in for 25 years, stay angry for 25 years, unless they feel they've been unjustly dealt with. And there is all that evidence to show we've been unjustly dealt with. So I am glad to see the leaders, though, have said they're going to take responsibility and move this forward. We need to get it sorted out quickly, really. I think almost sit us down in the one room. Don't let us out of the room till it's sorted. But get it sorted once and for all. And if you're going to do an apology, do a proper one that's agreed between us, that makes people feel that they've been heard and understood.
Okay. Austin, I know you have to go. You have a big day there yourself. I appreciate you giving us that time. And thanks for calling in with that, because I do think it's an important issue. I have Olivia O'Leary on the line. Olivia, you were listening to Austin there. Can you believe we're still at this stage of this story?
It's hard to believe it, Katie, because I had thought perhaps with the new Taoiseach that there might be a reset and that there might be a final acceptance that the state did neglect, the state did not behave as it should have. In this instance, it did not issue a public apology. And that was the whole point of the documentary that I did and went out in 1973 with a brilliant researcher, Aileen O'Doherty, which was that we finally got the then minister, Erskine Childers, in 73, this is, not earlier, to admit that the state hadn't issued a public apology. And when I asked him why, because we knew that a number of people had taken the pill after the state and everybody in authority knew that the drug was dangerous. When I asked him why, he said, listen, he said, I'm not saying that I would have done that now. I'm saying what the thinking was at the time. And the thinking at the time, seemingly according to the minister, was that they would frighten pregnant mothers by issuing a public warning. And and as a result, that some women might have miscarriages. And I was so befuddled by this answer. I said, "What? You took the chance that people would take the drug, and therefore have a thalidomide affected baby because you were afraid of frightening women in pregnancy." Now, it took a few years. We're very innocent, Katie. We've grown up an awful lot in recent decades. For me to realise that what they were worried about was that women might go and have abortions if they were afraid that they had taken thalidomide and were going to produce a deformed baby. Because in Belgium, Cardinal Swennens had warned about that exact thing. But because in Ireland you didn't even talk about abortion, it wasn't at the front of my mind even when I was doing the interview. I was just totally bamboozled as to why they had not issued a public apology.
Yeah, I remember seeing Olivia, and I spoke to you about this, I think back in 2013, when I came upon a document at that time which gave another insight into the thinking internally in government and at that time. And it referred to the danger of spreading hysteria among women and how this was considered the worst thing they could do. And this is why they had decided to keep this to the most minimal recall.
The women, the poor creatures, they were always hysterical. I mean, the thinking was just unbelievable. But I mean, that's what you were coming up against. And even when the government changed and Brendan Corish took over as head of the Department of Health and agreed, had an arrangement at least with the families, even then he had to fight the seniors in the Department of Health to get that agreed. And the day that he was bringing it in Cabinet, a paper came over that he would read, you know, describing what the deal was. And as far as I remember, the actual lump sum had been cut, and I think there was also a cut in whatever the allowance to people was going to be. And Corish took one look at this and told his press secretary, then Muireadh MacNeill, the government press secretary, to ring the department and explain to the secretary general that Mr. Corish wanted either the amended directive or else a letter of resignation. And within 20 minutes, the amended piece of paper had been delivered and was delivered in turn then to Cabinet. So that even within the Department of Health, there was a resistance. And, I mean, you were up against all these hierarchies, the hierarchy of the big, powerful drug companies, the hierarchy of the Department of Health and perhaps not wanting to accept responsibility for what had happened, and the Catholic hierarchy, as we would have known, so very powerful in this country, in the Department of Health. And all these unfortunate people and these young kids, that's what they were up against.
That was then, Olivia. This is now. And I mean, I've said it, and I said it to Austin there. I am genuinely, as a journalist following the story over a number of years now, I am completely baffled as to why this has not been sorted. It would seem to be an easy win for any Taoiseach or any Minister for Health to finally draw a line under this for, you know, for in comparison to some of the issues that have to be sorted out financially, for what would be a tiny amount of money. Can you figure out what's going on here?
All I can think of is lawyers in the background saying, be careful of the financial implications of accepting responsibility. There's a bit of me that hates to think that that may be the case, that it really comes down in the end to filthy money. But you would have thought, as you say, the group are so small. And, you know, I mean, I'm old enough to know that none of us are going to be around forever. So why the hell don't they settle? And is there still a resistance within the Department of Health to accepting that they and their political masters got things wrong?
That apology, or, well, not apology, as Austin has pointed out, this expression of sympathy and a statement that it's regretful that things were different then.
I mean, let's get the grammar right, guys. You know, regrettable at least. But I mean, it's so banal that it shocks me. If you are offended or if you were affected, we feel great sympathy with you. It is quite inadequate. They're going to have to go much further than that, and they're going to have to accept that by not issuing a public apology, they have a responsibility for what happened. When we were
a public recall. Sorry, Olivia, you're saying that, but because they didn't issue a public recall at the time.
A public recall. I'm getting mixed up between my apologies and my recalls. A public withdrawal of the drug. Because when we went down to the distributors to ask why or in what way the drug was withdrawn, we discovered that the slip of paper that was sent out indicating that this needed to be withdrawn wasn't the urgent one that went out. There was a colour coding, and because I don't have a copy of the slip, I won't even say what it was now, but there was a colour coding and they did not send out the most urgent withdrawal notice. The notice that went out would have been similar to the withdrawal of a batch of drugs because they were out of date or nearly out of date. So there was no sense of urgency about it at the time. So how they can claim that they have no responsibility, I don't know.
I read a list there of the most, we've become quite, state apologies become almost fashionable in the last decade in terms of the wrongs of the past that the state felt able to apologise for. And I think some of them felt deeply sincere and genuine. Would you agree with me there, Olivia, that we're able to do apologies when they are sincere?
Yeah, well, I don't know what's behind this, you know, whether there is a sense of fatigue with apologies, God between us and all harm. But it would seem to me it was a very feeble announcement indeed. And I still don't know what's going on behind it. Why won't they accept responsibility? What dark secret is there? I mean, I don't understand it, Kate.
Yeah, and as you say, and as Austin said, the way this is normally done is in conjunction with the people being apologised to, so that everybody's on board and everybody knows that. The fact that this was slipped out without any advance warning given to the survivors. And again, let me tell people, there's only 40 of them out there. There's only 40 people still alive that were affected by this. There's only, I think, something like 4 or 5 of their mothers who, you know, had lived with all that guilt over those years. There's only 4 or 5 of them still left. And as I say, there's a number of people who should have never been acknowledged. And I know the Thalidomide Association are working to get them acknowledged.
Are working. And that was because of the careless way that these things were being handed out like sweets, you know, by the drug company representatives. And as a result, as you know, then when people came to sort of claim whatever lump sum and allowance had been made, these people could not prove because they hadn't perhaps had the doctor handing out a prescription and a piece of paper. It was maybe taken out of a drawer and handed over. So that when they went back looking for proof, it wasn't there.
Yeah, the It's just devastating on so many levels that every time you can imagine the going through, you know, this in your head for the rest of your life if you were the mother of a child with this disability, these disabilities. Olivia.
And how you'd feel. Can I just say one thing before I go? There was a Professor Lentz in Germany who was, I think, the first doctor to begin to notice in his obstetrics clinic these malformations and whatever appearing with babies. He was the one who raised the flag first. He was the one who rang the company. And the company wouldn't have done anything if he didn't say, I'm going to the papers tomorrow. You will withdraw the drug tomorrow because I'm going to the papers tomorrow. He was a brave man. He was pretty well forced to leave his practice afterwards because of the strength of the drug companies and ended up as an academic. He is somebody who should be remembered with pride, Professor Lentz.
Professor Len Lentz. Olivia, thank you for that. Well said. And as you say, he's one of the heroes of the story. But unfortunately, we're still not at the end of the story. But thank you for that, Olivia. And you've done amazing work on the story yourself over the years. So
as
I want to acknowledge that.
As you have, Katie.
Okay. Take care, bye. Olivia. Thank you.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, we're going to move on from that and I want to go, bring in Jennifer. Jennifer, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Now, Jennifer, you've been through a very traumatic time. We were talking about this, I think it was the week before last, about restricted breed dogs and the damage that can happen when they get out of control. Tell me about your own story.
Tragically, our little miniature schnauzer was fatally attacked on the 27th of June on the Greenway in Westport. She was being walked by my father-in-law and he passed by two young girls who had a pit bull on a lead. But unfortunately, the pit bull broke free and mauled our little schnauzer.
And I'm looking at a picture of your little dog here. Gorgeous, gorgeous dog. He didn't survive.
No, she didn't. The attack was so vicious. She sustained too many injuries that unfortunately, you know, the vet wasn't able to save her. Yeah, it was a very vicious attack.
And it must have been very traumatic for your father-in-law as well to witness that.
Absolutely. I mean, the dog came from behind and it was such a brutal attack. He wasn't able to get down towards Iris. He wasn't able to get the pit bull off her or save her. And he's 81 years of age and having to witness that, like, it's a very traumatic experience for him.
I know you wanted to know if anyone had any information to share. I know you have spoken to the guards about it. We have just a very brief statement here. I'll read it out. Gardaí in Westport received a report and are investigating an incident in which a dog was fatally injured following an attack by another dog on the Greenway Walk, Westport. The incident occurred shortly after 7 p.m. on Thursday, the 27th of June. They say anyone who may have camera footage, including dash cam, and was travelling in the area at the time were asked to make this footage available to the investigating Gardaí. And anyone with any information are asked to contact Westport Gardaí Station, and they give the number there. How are you now after this? I mean, this is just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, look, we're heartbroken and we're upset. You know, she was a very important part of our life. We fully understand we're never going to get her back. But, you know, those two girls left the scene at the time. You know, the pool was covered in blood. There was a lot of blood left on the footpath. They went back in home.
Okay, and I just don't want to because because there is a guard investigation, Jennifer. I don't want to go down that road with you because I don't want to compromise any investigation that might be ongoing. If you understand me, because that's important. Just tell me about it's Iris, isn't it? Was Iris, your little mini schnauzer, and they're gorgeous dogs. They're a very popular breed at the moment. I see them every day out walking. They're really adorable, an adorable breed.
Yeah, look, they're very sweet natured, full of energy. You know, they're a great family pet, and unfortunately, she just came to a very tragic end that didn't need to happen. You know, she was attacked by a restricted breed of dog who wasn't muzzled. You know, the law is there and it's in place, but there's nobody enforcing it.
That is the thing. The obviously people are allowed to have these breeds of dog, but the restrictions are that they have to be on a lead at all times, a short lead. They have to be muzzled if they're out in public, and they have to, the person in control of them has to be over the age of 16. Isn't they're the key?
Yeah. You know, and Iris's attack isn't an isolated pit bull attack. You know, just from my short amount of research, there was 4 other attacks in the month of June alone. You know, so
yeah, we did. We heard some very, very upsetting stories, I have to say, when we covered this the week before last. It doesn't bear thinking about, really, that you would be out. Can I ask you, are you going to get another dog? Because two friends of mine lost their dogs in kind of traumatic circumstances over the last number of weeks, and they very quickly got another dog. And I wondered how people feel about that. Do people feel like it's too soon to replace their pet, or how do you feel about it, Jennifer?
Oh, 100% too soon. Yeah. I couldn't imagine replacing her. No, not at this current time, and I don't think for quite a long time. She was irreplaceable to us, so it's not something that, for us anyway, it's not something that I could imagine doing.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry, Jennifer. It's a horrific thing to go through, and to lose what is really a member of your family. I know when a pet is cherished like that, so you have all our sympathies for that. And as I say, the Gardaí are ready to take calls if anyone has more information about that. But I have to take a break now. Jennifer, thank you.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And I just want to say thanks to Jennifer there again. She was on Midwest Radio telling her story, and we're glad she joined us to put out the word there. Okay, that's that. I want to move on now. I was talking to Louise in the last when I was doing the link on this program about elocution lessons. Louise Duffy told me she had elocution lessons. I think they have subsequently been called speech and drama lessons. But it is an interesting one, isn't it, that we want to round our vowels in this way. And I wondered how many other children had it. Mary Halligan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
You had it right through school, did you?
We did, Katie. We did it through primary school. And now, I don't know whether it was actually part of the curriculum. I probably wasn't. It was just, I went to an all-girls school, St. Mary's Primary School in Cove in County Cork. And it was one of the nuns that used to do the elocution lessons. We could hardly pronounce the word elocution, you know, we were so young, but anyway, I think it used to be like electrocution classes. But anyway, she was Sister Manuel, a member of the Mercy Nuns in Cove, and Sister Manuel is still alive and well in Cove, celebrated her 90th birthday not so long ago, and she used to take us for elocution classes.
And what did it involve?
Well, they were, you know, we learned little poems and we did little rhymes, and then she prepared us every year for a competition in Fish Matthew in Father Matthew Hall in Cork, and the Fish Matthew competitions still run to this day. And I'm talking about, you know, 50 years ago that we went off every year for Fish Matthew. And we recited our poem on stage, and I never won anything, but I mean, I went off every year again in the hopes that I might win a medal.
Do you remember any of the poems or any of the rhymes you used to learn?
I can remember one of the rhymes. It was like, you know, we used to do it at the start of the class, and it was my needle's too thin for my thread to pass through. So this is what I'll do. I'll ask my mother to buy me another, and with it, a thimble too.
So that was sorting out your THs, obviously.
That was sorting out the THs, which there was huge emphasis on the THs, like, you know. So, and I suppose it all was probably stood to me.
Do you think, I was going to say, do you think you actually speak differently now? Because you have beautiful Cork tones there,
well, yeah,
Mary.
My best Cork accent, yeah.
But do you think you speak differently now because of those lessons?
I think we do, you know. I think, you know, like that, you know, I suppose it's like anything that you learn at a young age, you'll always remember, you know. I mean, I could try and learn something last week and I probably have forgotten this week, you know. But I mean, something that I learned over 50 years ago, I can still remember, you know. So
do you think it was kind of trying to knock the cork out of your accent, or like what was the goal, do you think, of these lessons?
I suppose it was to, I mean, I suppose like to learn to, like they said, to speak proper, you know, to learn how to speak and present ourselves. And then I suppose there was a certain amount of confidence building in it as well, because, you know, you went off and you were on stage and you recited your little poem, and, you know, that whether it was just an interest the nuns had, or, I mean, I can say it was part of the curriculum because I don't know.
I wonder, did the boys get the same lessons, or was that something that nice girls were taught?
I'd say it might have been something that nice girls were taught inside, and, you know, we were an all-girls school. And, you know, there was no question of payment, you know. There was no, you know, there was no fee that I'm aware of anyway. I don't think there was. And whether there had to be a little fee paid to take part in Fish Match, you know, or not, I don't know. But we went off anyway. And my mother, Lord of Mercy in her, used to say, oh, my God, I meant you a Fish Match, you, and I get a pain in my head because you'd have to sit listening to 100 children reciting the same poem.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, it was really torture.
Do you think there was an idea, and I don't know, maybe it's still, there's, maybe it is not just an idea, maybe it's a fact that you had to talk proper, you know, to be a kind of an Eliza Doolittle to get on in life, that this would get you a better job if you had the right THs and
Well, it's funny you say that now, Katie, because my sister actually works in recruitment and job interview preparation and everything, and I did run that question past her there when I thought that I might be coming on. And you know, like she says, like, you know, that obviously in an interview that they're looking out for your communication skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose, you know, your speech is your first form of communication skills, you know. And if you're in any kind of a position where you're, you know, meeting people or on phone, mm-hmm. I suppose we are all looking for correct dictions from people. And yeah, it's probably something that we just took for granted, you know. I mean, I suppose we were very fortunate in that we had these lessons, and we just thought it was all part of going to school.
Yeah. Will you hang on, Mary? I've got Billy Trainer on the other line. Billy, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you, Katie?
Yeah, your late mum was a speech and drama teacher.
She was, yes. She was a little powerhouse. She reared 7 of us and then went back to college and trained as a speech and drama teacher. She'd always wanted to work in drama in some way or another. And she ended up being a fairly influential person, I think, in the future of elocution in the country, because at the time, pupils were taught with an English accent, basically. That was the standard for examinations.
This is the British received, the BBC accent, basically, BBC newsreader accent, yeah.
And if you even look back to our own newsreaders in the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s, they all spoke with terribly English sounds, you know? And that was kind of taken as the
right way, the right way to talk, yeah.
Exactly. And she fought tooth and nail. And I was saying earlier, I'm not entirely sure how many other people were involved, but I know she fought very hard to have that standard changed by the governing body for speech and drama, which was the English Speaking Board. Not sure if it still is that, but it was back then. And they changed it to the aim being regional accent with clear speech.
So there was actually a debate within the elocution, speech and drama community, basically. When are we talking about? Are we talking about the 80s or the 70s?
70s, yes.
About the right way to speak, basically, and what elocution should be promoting. That's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She tell me more about your mom. She sounds amazing.
Ah, she was fantastic. She ended up as an examiner for the Leinster School of Music and examined in schools all around the country. And I think that this was what had prompted her desire to change this, because she said she'd go to West Cork and have a little 7-year-old come in to say, waiting, waiting, waiting for the party to begin, which is just ludicrous. And the strain on the poor kids of trying to speak in a totally alien way was ridiculous, you know? And it wasn't helping them to achieve clear speech as far as she was concerned. This was just something that they adopted for one poem once a year, and that was it, you know?
Let me ask, as you're there, Mary is still there. Mary, yeah. Would you have spoken like that? Waiting, waiting, waiting?
No, I don't think so. I think we held on to the good Cove Cork accent. But it's good. Funny that you're not a caller there. Now should be talking, you know, speaking about that, because a lot of the children now are speaking with American accents, so it mightn't be any harm for you know, to go back to the regional accents, you know. But and as well, there I actually had it forgotten now as well, but we did those examinations in the schools as well.
Do you know, I've just remembered that I had a cert at some stage of my childhood from the Leinster School of Music, Speech and Drama.
It was probably my mum.
It could have been your mum. I do remember being put through my paces and being terrified.
There were certificates and you had to recite a poem and read an extract and do a mime.
That's exactly it, yeah. That was exactly it.
Yeah. I'd forgotten now, actually.
Billy, and your mum did travel the country then doing these exams?
Oh, she did. And she taught for a while in a very deprived area of Dublin in Donore Avenue and was paid each week for the classes. And then the brothers came to her and said, look, the parents can't afford it and the government has removed it from the curriculum, which they did. And I do think that was in the 70s sometime. And she continued to teach there for nothing for a number of years because she loved the kids and they were coming up on sixth class. I think she only ever really had the fifth and sixth class primary lads. And she felt that these were kids who might well leave education. And if she could give them clear speech, you know, they might have a better chance of getting a decent job or whatever. And years later, I met a couple of men in completely different circumstances because I looked quite like her. Said to me, are you Maureen Burke's daughter? I remember her from teaching me in Donore Avenue.
Oh, isn't that lovely?
Yeah, it was super.
And remembered her fondly, obviously.
Very much so. And she took them to the FET. She wrote a whole small theatre piece about Robert Emmett's trial and took them to the FET Matthew with it. And they won. And I'll never forget those kids, the excitement of them. They
beat Mary's gang. They actually came home with a medal from Fesh Matthew.
Sorry, Mary.
Was she a stickler for anything in terms of, you know, things we shouldn't be doing?
Yeah. Oh, my God. The TH thing was just, you know, constant. Or you'd come running in from school and say, are there any biscuits? And she'd say, excuse me, did Annie just walk into the room? Because the correct pronunciation of that word is any. She would insist on the absolute correct pronunciation of everything, but not a change of accent, you know. Clear speech, that was her thing.
Yeah, she sounds absolutely brilliant. We're getting so many calls in on this, Billy. There's lots of people have memories of doing these classes when they were kids. Let me bring in Frances. Frances, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
What age bracket would you be now, Frances, do you mind me asking?
70.
Right, okay.
I was educated by the Presentation Convent Sisters in Lucan.
Yes.
and they brought in an elocution teacher so that we could, when we were out and about in the big bad world, that we would be able to carry ourselves and people would be able to understand what we were talking about, understand our accents. I suppose then I had a kind of a Dublin accent, which I still have. But they were nuns thought they would bring us up as ladies, and ladies had to speak in a certain way and act in a certain way. So hence the elocution teacher.
And was it very clear that that's what it was about? It was about, you know, ironing out your I suppose ironing out your vowel sounds or broadening your vowel sounds. And
absolutely, absolutely. It was. I loved it. However, a previous caller called them electrocution lessons, which some of my classmates called it because they hated it. They couldn't get their heads around it or their tongues around it. I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And like I said, she's a researcher. I currently am a reader in our church, and everybody in the church on the morning can understand everything I communicate to them. So I brought that with me along the way.
I was going to say you speak very, very clearly, Frances. I honestly, I would have said that if we weren't talking about elocution. So you obviously take pride in articulating.
Yes,
properly.
Absolutely. Yes, because I think it's very important.
Do you think, though, that there might be a bit of snobbery around, you know, accents? Like you were saying, you might have had a Dublin accent, that there's certain accents that people are encouraged to soften or move away from.
Yes, yes. I think perhaps the nuns of my era were very much of that mindset. I know we have moved on considerably since that. But yes, I think that was their aim at the end of the day.
Do you think it's still around?
To some extent, I think it is. In fact, I have to say, I sometimes listen to continuity announcers, and I'm thinking they could do with some elocution lessons.
No names now. No names now, Frances.
Absolutely not.
I can tell you that we have a lot of listeners out there who are very, very quick to write in and let us know if we have tripped over words in the wrong way. And I'm always happy. Thank you, caller. Thank you, listeners, who give me those bits of advice, because I'm always, always, as you can imagine, delighted to hear what I'm doing wrong. Frances, thank you for that. I want to bring in, who have I got now? Dorothy?
Yes. Hi. How are you, Casey?
I'm very well.
Yes.
So you are the real deal. You actually teach speech and drama yourself.
Yes, I teach speech and drama myself, and it has changed a lot down the years. Now, you were asking that last lady how old she was. Mm-hmm. I'm in my 60s, so I would have done elocution lessons in school when I was in school, and it was, you know, quite very much now, brown cow, you know, it was repeating those things. But speech and drama now anymore is very much about teaching the child to learn about their own voice and how to use it to the best of their ability. And, you know, by doing that, how they go about doing that, and we teach them to learn to open their mouth when they're speaking. Now, not overdo it, you know, to learn to shape the sounds that make the words and, you know, remind them about pause and all these things. But it's in a very casual way. You know, it's in a casual way.
OK, I'm becoming completely self-conscious about how I sound myself right now in this conversation. But some accents, we mentioned the TH there. That was the one that Mary could remember from her from her childhood. There are certain accents that tend not to put emphasis on the TH. Is that accent or is that a speech problem?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's probably something. It's a habit, really. In most cases, it's a habit. And you can just by showing the child how you pronounce, how the TH sound is formed, and they will work on it. And they will perfect it themselves then, because what you're trying to do is make the child aware of it without making themselves conscious.
I was just going to say, though, but I mean, should we change it? That particular one, I'm thinking, because it grates on some people's ears, but other people think, well, that's the way we speak. That's my accent. That's what all my friends sound like. Why should I sound any different?
Yeah, well, I don't know if the TH would be an accent. I would never change an accent. I think an accent is lovely. It's unique to that person. And everybody's speaking voice is unique to them. And it's very, very special. But a TH, I think it's no harm in just, you know, what we would do is try to perfect it. But if they can get the happy medium between what I'm telling them and what they have been doing, they're mm-hmm. doing really well, you know. But like, again, not making them too self-conscious of it. But, like, apart from that, just teaching everybody, and, like, it's a very important thing, that the difference in tone when people speak, the pace that they speak at, you know, and using pause and emphasising just key words in what they're talking about. Now, this may not be necessarily in just a general conversation, but what you're trying to do is build confidence in the child. And that's done through speech exercises and drama. You get up, you do a little improvisation, you might do a mime, you'll do, you know, a little drama in groups. And where you're putting themselves into a different situation and acting like that, forgetting all about themselves. And it's just so good for the confidence.
Do children do this in school now? I mean, obviously, a lot of the callers we're getting are people who did it in school back in the 70s, when it was kind of fashionable to teach little girls in particular, I think, as I say, how to speak properly. But Are parents now putting their children forward for elocution lessons?
They are. But we're calling it, you see, under the umbrella of what we call elocution is now called speech and drama. You know, we have public speaking and effective communication. And this is, as you can understand, this is just so important these days, communication with young people. And just getting them to lift their head, look at the person that they're talking to. And you know that they're learning all about this. You would teach two children to introduce themselves if they come home and they bring a friend. Well, introduce the friend to their mother or whatever. Just little simple things like that. That's communication. Public speaking today is all about. I mean, that's coming in now in junior cert. So I would start little bits of public speaking with even fifth and sixth class, where I'd get them to stand up and would you tell me all about animals, and or tell me all about cats, because I don't know what they look like. Pretend the class don't know what they look like, and they will get up and they will describe a cat, what it looks like, what it sounds like, what it might eat. And by doing that, they're learning to be descriptive in their language. They're communicating with the people that are sitting in front of them. You know, they're using their emphasis to try to get their point across. You know, they're using pace. And they've got the confidence to stand up and do it. And after they sit down, they've got more confidence again. You know, it's just what it is a gentle way of teaching them to use their voice to the best of their ability, but not putting on an accent or anything like that. That's gone.
That's
out
gone.
The window.
Is
yeah.
it? So the received English is...
Dorothy,
thanks. I cannot tell you, we are getting so many calls in on this. So many people are interested in this.
It's an invaluable subject. It really is. It's something for life. It's not for your next exam or anything. It's something that you learn for life. Okay. You know, it's life skill.
Okay. Well, I have somebody on the other line. Thanks for that, Dorothy. Really interesting
to hear from a
teacher's perspective. Monica, good afternoon.
Oh, hello, Katie. How are you? I think that lady was my teacher. Because
really?
I think everything she said just made sense to me. You know, I heard it, you know, when I was learning I used to live in Finglas West. And I went to the Holy Faith Convent, St. Bridget's, and we had elocution every single Friday, and it was 6p, well, the old 6p.
And your mother gave you the 6p every Friday for this?
Well, we got actually one in six, sixpence for dancing classes, sixpence for elocution lessons and sixpence for something else. I think it was some sort of drill program we had, or PE or something. So that was every single week, and honestly, the training that we got was absolutely amazing. And they always say about the nuns and how bad they were, but you know something? They left me with this legacy of being a confident person, and I feel I can speak, you know, relatively clearly most of the time anyway.
Which nuns were in the convent in Finglas West?
Yeah, they were the Holy Faith Convent.
Yeah, because St. Bridget's. I went to a presentation convent myself, and I know one of our callers there earlier, and they were a great order for educating girls in particular.
Absolutely, educating girls. And I remember there was one particular nun, Sister Evangelist, she was very young, and she introduced us to classical music, and she brought in a record player and the LP of it was Swan Lake, and honestly, I never ever forget that, never. She introduced us to classical
music. Isn't that just
music.
Brilliant, like exposing children to music that you just wouldn't ever have had access
well,
to at that stage?
No, sure. I mean, how would you in those days? Like, you know, you definitely wouldn't. You'd have the radio on, but you wouldn't know it, you know, but she taught us that. And they taught us so much more. I can actually say a poem that I learned then. Well, can I say it?
Go on.
Yeah, okay. This is the night mail crossing the border, bringing the cheque and the postal order. Letters for the rich, letters for the poor, the shop at the corner and the girl next door. Pulling up Beechock a steady climb, the gradient's against her, but she's on time.
Monica,
it's about the steam train.
Said beautifully. I would definitely have given you 10 out of 10 if I was here from the Leinster School of Speech and Drama for that.
Oh, thank you very much. But listen, I think that, you know, our new Taoiseach has really benefited from his drama classes and speech and drama in his school, because I learned that in the paper, I read the paper, that he actually did some classes in school, he studied it. And you know, something has really stood to him. Because he's so, the way he speaks, his confidence, and just the way he delivers, you know, what he has to say in such a, you know, easy, simplified sentences.
Yes.
I think it has stood to him anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think it stands to everybody, really, to be honest with you. I think so.
Yes, I think we undervalue communication skills, I think, but when people have them, it can take them very, very far. Monica, thanks for that. Lovely talking to you. Fergal, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie.
Yes, your Auntie Anne was in the Reardons.
Well, she did a little part in it. She was a friend of Biddy White Lennon, and she was in the Reardons a little bit, and she was a stage manager there with yourselves on Fair City, and she passed away last year.
Aww.
So it just reminded me of your programme of when she used to come down to us at home in Wicklow. She'd teach us together our elocution, because she was teaching elocution at the time. And we used to love doing it with her. She made it so much fun, you know.
And how did she approach it when she was teaching? She just did it with the as kids, her niece and nephews.
Yeah, and maybe the odd poem and that we I remember that she taught us, not knowing what the relevance was, but we knew them off by heart, you know, how to say them and stuff like that. Like she taught us Dapple Grey, that one. And it's still... fully, I remember every word.
Go on, give us a blast of Dapple Grey.
I had a little pony, his name was Dapple Grey. I lent him to a lady to ride a mile away. Well, she whipped him and she lashed him and she rode him through the mire. Now, I would not lend my pony now for all that lady's hire. What do you think?
That's a round of applause, Fergal. It's incredible how these stick. It sticks in your head, these poems, isn't it? I mean, that's not today or yesterday you learned that.
She was so, we used to love, because she was famous. She was in TV and stuff and with RTE doing work, and we all thought she was famous. She was so elegant, and she used to come out in her little sports car. We were living on a farm, so it was so nice. Always on her visits. She's my godmother, and I miss her dearly.
Yeah. And that's Anne Myler, isn't it?
Anne Myler Caffrey, she married Alan Caffrey, who I think also worked in RTE,
Lovely to hear about that, your glamorous Auntie Anne. Thanks for that, Fergal.
No, thanks a million, Kate.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we've so many people that want to get in on this. Cora, you've been hanging on there for us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Now, yeah, we were talking about...
Want to say,
sorry, Cora, yeah, you were going to talk about the TH. I was talking to...
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, there is no TH sound in Irish. The broad T covers a range of sounds from T to TH, the same as D and DH cover the same sound. So Irish-speaking brains are hardwired to process T and TH as the same sound. So there's no TH sound in Irish. Do you understand? We're hardwired to process it as T, the same as we'll say the Japanese people process L and R as one sound and can't differentiate. So it's a cultural pronunciation. It's not incorrect.
Okay, so this is Hiberno English, of course, that we all speak.
That's it. So you're trying to beat the BBC accent into the Irish children, whereas they're not hardwired that way. We, as Irish people, can't differentiate between T and TH sound. It doesn't exist. The sound isn't there. It's the same sound, T and TH.
So you're saying we really should have no issue at all with saying dis, dat, dies, and does?
No.
Because that's...
Dave Byrne had a language expert on years and years back, and he said that he was explaining how the Irish brain is hardwired that way. We cannot process between T and TH, and the T, like tings or whatever, it's perfectly acceptable. And Gay Byrne always said that. He said, no, dear, he'd always say it's T is perfectly acceptable to do the broad T sound. So that is, you know, if anyone wants to research that. So
okay.
It's not incorrect.
Well, if anyone, so if anyone's been corrected out there, they can say Gay Byrne said... Said it was okay.
Well, he had the language expert on. This was years back. So I researched it then, of course, and I double-checked it before I got on to you. And this is 100% accurate.
Okay, I love that, Cora. Thanks for that. Because I think a lot of people are getting their wrists slapped over that over the years. So you're doing nothing wrong. Damien, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes, you did elocution from a very young age.
Yes. My brother had a lisp, and my mother, rather than just send him to elocution, sent myself and my two brothers down with him. So we did speech and drama and elocution with a neighbour. She ran speech and drama. So we loved it that much that we stayed at it for several years. So it was about, it must have been 6, 7 when I started doing it. We did it in Leixlip with Margaret Kenny was her name.
Mm-hmm.
And we put on all sorts of shows in the town as well. And I did the Royal Irish Academy of Speech and Drama.
That sounds very posh. Very posh.
I know, yes. I've got a certificate as well. We had to do the same thing, which was to do a poem, which I still remember part of.
Go on. We're letting everyone very quickly give us a few lines.
It's Someone by Walter Delamere. Someone came knocking on my wee small door. Someone came knocking. I'm sure, sure, sure. I listened, I opened, I looked to left and right, but ne'er there was a stirring in the still dark night. And you had to do all the gestures with it. So you can imagine I was very excitable at this presentation.
Damien,
but it stood me in good stead.
Yes.
Because I qualified as a solicitor and I did a lot of advocacy in court. And, you know, being able to slow down your breathing and talk and present, it has helped me over the years. So it stood me in good stead. So I say, you know, it did really help my confidence, I have to say.
Yes, that's what we're hearing from everybody. There's nobody regrets doing it for sure anyway, Damien, although we're hearing some people did regard it as electrocution lessons. Thanks for that, Damien. I'm just trying to get a few more callers in because I'm watching the clock here. Will I bring in Anne? Anne, good afternoon.
Hello, Katie. How are you? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Now, you had a very specific reason for needing elocution lessons, Anne.
Yeah, I was born in 1959 and I had a cleft palate. And anyway, I At the time, it was only treated in Dublin by a famous Kerry doctor, Dr. Prendeville, and he did several operations over the years for me. But I'd say I was about 4 or 5 when my mum was recommended admitting me to Dr. Stephen's Hospital in Dublin, and I can remember different long stints, but I can't remember how many. And I was treated to elocution lessons. Now, the reason being from Dr. Prendeville at the time is he knew my mother had young children at home and that we were out in the country, that she didn't drive, and that for every weekly elocution lesson, I may miss 2, you know. So that's how I was recommended to stay inside. And I just remember meeting fabulous women. No, I was 5 or 6. I didn't know whether they were women or old age people or anything, but they had no resources to copy books, and they might draw, we'll say, a horse or a cow or whatever. They were brilliant. So
And I'm going to have to cut you off because I have another ad break to take and I'm nearly out of time. You think it stood by you greatly anyway, just very quickly.
Absolutely. So much so when I had children of my own, I got them to go as well.
And lovely to talk to you. Sorry I didn't have more time for you. And I'm sorry, I know there's other callers hanging on there. We might come back to this again, but I have to take my last break now.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And that's all we have time for today. On sound, we had Harry Bookless. Our broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin. And today's programme was produced by Shan O'Gorman. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon and stand by now for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Summer's here. Spruce up your bedroom for less with our sizzling summer sale offers at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.